This podcast is sponsored by Athletic Greens. Now, I'm sure you've heard of Athletic Greens from a thousand different other podcasts, but the reason why I think this is the case is because it works. I've been using it for years, and the biggest benefits that I've realized is that it gives me more energy. I feel like I'm getting a full and healthy diet. My poops are better, and I'm sorry to say, but it's true. And so if you're somebody who really wants a healthy diet where they're confident they're getting all their micronutrients, go on and head over to drinkag1.com/Farzad. drinkag1.com/Farzad, where you'll get a free vitamin D plus K2 bottle and 5 free travel packs. Thank you so much to Athletic Greens. And now onto the podcast.
We are going to need a lotto ticket like AI to hit big in order not to drown in interest payments.
It feels like we're playing with fire. If AI doesn't happen,
but if AI happens, we're also.
Yeah, it just feels like we're playing with fire.
Well, I think those economists, and there's a very specific reason I think that. It's called history. They know that they are lying. They know what is the lie that I have to publicly support. How is that not a big fat conspiracy?
The whole concept of a national debt, like the more I think about it, like the less it makes sense to me. Because we're basically saying like, hey, at some point in the future, when growth will definitely stall for an extended period of time, and we're not able to take in nearly as much tax revenue as a society, whichever generation is there is going to have to deal with the debt.
We hate our kids or our grandkids or maybe our great kids. We don't know, but one of them we certainly hate.
We hate somebody in the future. someone's in the future. One of our generations is going to have to deal with our lack of willingness to hone in our complete disregard for spending more than we take in, which for the United States for the last, it's been the last 23 years, you know, the last 23 years in a row, the United States has run a deficit, and that deficit comes from us spending more as a country than we take in. And then we shore up that deficit by taking out debt and by printing new money, which either means we pay interest on that debt or we pay for the printing of money through inflation, which is basically a passive tax on everybody.
Well, let's call it exactly what it is. Inflation is giving to rich people to steal from poor people. Like, that is exactly what inflation is. Yeah, when the government prints money, they steal poor people's purchasing power. And they give it to people who own things, which are the rich. So like, hey, poor people, we're going to protect you from all these evil billionaires by taxing the living bejesus out of them. All the while, the thing that we're going to really be doing is stealing your money and making sure that people who own things still own the same amount of stuff. But yeah, I mean, well, the whole unrealized gain tax thing is another wrench in the cog of that. But that's the argument for printing money is definitely stealing from poor people to give to the rich.
I think most people have no idea of this. Like, they just accept the concept because it just exists, right? If you really think about the United States, at least this is sort of, if I'm speaking from my own lived experience, I didn't really understand what inflation even was until I took the time to sit down and learn about it, either through like a YouTube video showed up or on social media, I saw some video or something, and then I took it upon myself to go in and actually learn what inflation was. And even just the simple concept of like, hey, inflation going down doesn't mean prices are going down. It means that the rate at which you lose the value of your money slowed down, but it still loses value.
You know, groceries are still going to be more expensive 5 years from now than they are today. You know, if we don't figure out a way to solve that problem.
Yeah.
And unless you get more raises than all the things are getting more expensive at a certain speed. And unless your raises are, you know, increasing faster than that, you're losing your ability to maintain the standard of living that you have today. Like, your rent's getting more expensive. Your groceries are getting more expensive. Your internet's getting more expensive. Your car is getting more expensive. Your insurance is getting more expensive. And so if you're not in one of those like small sectors of the economy where you're able to just get big fat bonus raises, you know, all the dang time, then it feels like 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, you're going to be in a heck of a lot worse place than you are today, not a better one. And that's, yeah, that is what inflation is.
100%. And the one thing, I've been working on my video, this script that I showed you yesterday, right? And like the thing that I'm really trying to deep dive is like, how can I, number one, ensure that I'm talking about the debt and deficit situation of the United States and smartly. And then secondly, I'm trying to like understand the side that says this is actually a good thing for the United States. You do want to run a deficit because you're taking advantage of the United States leadership from an economic perspective, because we're the world's reserve currency. And so that gives us the right to print money. And I'm like, and like the thing that I keep heading, like I keep hitting my head against the wall, right? Number one, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around that concept. Like I don't consider myself to be a genius, but I'm not an idiot. I like to think, I hope. I mean, Matt Smith would disagree, obviously, but we will set him aside because he's literally the biggest idiot I've ever met. Shout out, Matt, piece of shit. So that's one. I actually love him, but he can go fuck himself. So that's Matt. So number one, it's hard for me to wrap my head around that concept. It's like it requires some convoluted understanding of the economy, and like super genius people, this is like a piece of cake for them to understand and wrap their head around. Okay, cool. So I'm not going to let that be the limiting factor for me to say I do not think this is a good idea.
Well, I think those economists are retarded, and there's a very specific reason I think that. It's called history. All of these things have been tried before, and there's a very specific arc that they follow. Go read Ray Dalio's book, The Changing World Order. It spells it out very explicitly what's going on. Like, sure, you can borrow against being the world's reserve currency for a while, but eventually that bill comes due for an empire, just the same as it does for anything else. And I mean, there are lots of great truisms and principles that my dad taught me when I was growing up. But one of the simplest and most profound is, if your outgo exceeds your income, then your upkeep will be your downfall. And that is what we are doing at a national level with just increasing enthusiasm right now. And there is always a time limitation on how long you can do that for.
Yes. And so that's exactly it, right? And so like the conclusion I come to is like, okay, how come when we apply that concept to the individual, which is like the more, if you spend more than you earn, so if what you're paying for is costs more than the amount of money you're able to bring in net at the end of the year, which means that to shore up that thing, that difference between how much you spend and how much you earn, you have to either take out debt, or in the case of the United States, you just print money. You just make the money out of thin air, right? How come if we do that for 23 years straight as individuals, we are in financial ruin? We will have too much debt. Our interest payments will be too high. And unless we're able to generate more income over time to try and pay down that debt, or at least have a reasonable ratio, which is basically impossible unless you are like one of the very few people that become ultra successful in a generation, let's say, right? Let's say like you just get to a point where you have generate massive wealth, right? So how come for the other 99.9% of the rest of us, that thing that we just described ends up bankrupting us 100% of the time, right? How come we're not taking that into account? You know, how come we're not saying like, hey, as an individual, this will ruin me, but once you have a collection of people that come together and form a country and they do that principle, it's actually a good thing? Like, where is it? Like, how come the transit of property doesn't work there? Like, help me understand that.
Because we haven't gone bankrupt yet. Duh.
Oh, okay. It hasn't happened yet, so it's not going to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. So that's kind of like where it feels like such a dumb idea. Like, I get it. Like, I get capitalize on the United States greatness. Fantastic. But at what expense? At the expense of future generations. That's literally what we're saying.
A lot of people know how to manage their finances and use debt responsibly in the process and become successful and be able to meet all their obligations. You know, there's a reason that credit scores are a thing. It's like, are you or are you not going to be able to pay this debt off in the future? And that's where, you know, having the world's reserve currency is like, oh, you have a credit score of 800. But at some point, like, you can overspend your ability to pay off your loans, even with a credit score of 800. Like, millionaires go bust all the time. And just because you have a lot of money and you've always been able to pay all your debts off in the past doesn't mean that you can't do some sort of a deal that falls through and then poof, you're wiped out. And we see this happen all the time in markets. And, you know, big people and big companies and, you know, all kinds of things, just it seemed like they were invincible and then they're gone. You know, whether it's an Enron or the, you know, global financial crisis in 2008 of just all the whole, like, I mean, Enron is tied in with the mortgage-backed securities and all that stuff. Like, oh, this is a thing that totally works. And like, this is an ironclad way to make money until it's not anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, 2008, for some reason, it's like a perfect example of that, over leveraged on an asset that became less and less worth. Like, there wasn't nearly as worth as much as people thought it was, either, you know, because of the fuckery at the S&P and Moody's and stuff like that, whatever it may be. But the ending principle was you were over leveraged. That's what it was. And like, to say that, go ahead.
Well, and it was over leveraged because of subprime mortgages, which means for laymen, they were lending to people who didn't have the ability to pay off the loan. Exactly. And so they said this loan is worth $100,000. But because they had given it to someone who had no ability to pay the loan, it was actually worth like $5,000 because that's all the money that they could get out of that person before they're like, nope, I can't take this. Like, I'm going to get evicted. And you do that enough times over enough loans and you say, you know, this whole loan portfolio is worth $1 billion, but you've given it to a bunch of people who have zero ability to pay off loans. And then you're like, oh crap, no, this thing is worth like $10 million instead of $1 billion. Like, that's a big fat write down. And that is what that, you know, was the underpinning, like the basics of what happened in 2008. And I mean, that to me looks like what we're kind of doing. You know, eventually we'll say, hey, we don't have enough money to pay on our debt payments. Like, we've already got interest payments on our debt that exceeds our national defense budget today. If we just keep doing that, and like, we are going to need a lotto ticket like AI to hit big in order not to drown in interest payments and have to declare, you know, to basically default or declare bankruptcy on all this debt that we have.
It feels like we're playing with fire. If AI doesn't happen, we're fucked. This is literally like the thing, right? If AI doesn't happen, which, I mean, we both think it will in some respects, right? But let's say...
But if AI happens, we're also fucked.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, it just feels like we're playing with fire. It just really feels like we're playing with fire. And like the other thing that this whole thing gets stuck with is like, okay, so if you're creating an environment, well, you're saying that taking on debt and printing money is a good thing. All you're doing is you're creating an incentive for a very inefficient body that has shown over the course of decades incapable of being financially, let's say, efficient with the deployment of its cash, which is the US government, right? And we're telling the US government, which is supposed to be we're supposed to have representatives in there that have our best interest in mind, yet Congress has 19% approval rating. We're telling those people, spend as much as you want. Are you kidding me? Like, does that seem like the right incentive structure? But like, hey, you're already really bad at spending money. We know for a fact that these cost-plus contracts, which basically create an incentive for every company to overcharge the government, we're also telling those people, like, hey, by the way, you can borrow and print as much money as you want to pay for those things as well. And you're telling me that's somehow a good idea. Are you kidding me? You know, it makes no sense. Dude, it makes no sense. And so the conclusion I'm coming to is that the root cause of the problem is that nobody knows this is happening. if enough people knew this was happening, they would do something about it. Honestly, like if they actually understood the crux of the, and I don't think it's a, I don't think the population lacks the ability to understand this. I just think there is a lack of this message being in front of enough people. You know what I'm saying? I that's my theory.
I hope you're right. That might, I hope you're right.
I feel very naive and positive today, Hans.
Good for you.
I gave my family a big old hug and kiss this morning. I feel good.
Yeah, maybe maybe awareness is the piece. You know, the reason that this exists is because there's a lot of people that make a lot of money for not much work based on this exact system. That, you know, there's a, when you have a system that is able to generate wealth, then you also end up having a free rider problem where people try to come in and steal off of the thing that is generating wealth. Every healthy, robust system needs a way to deal with this problem. And the way that there's a conception that I really like that says that, you know, the three main sources of that are chiefs, priests, and thieves. And the thieves here are the government, you know, the DOD contractors, the like the, well, let's talk about the Department of Education. They have a huge budget. Have education outcomes improved or have they
gotten worse
since the No Child Left Behind Act? Thank you, George W. Bush.
Shout out George W. Bush.
Oh, man. So there's one example. The other, okay, look at Boeing. Yeah, let's go to the moon, Boeing. Oh, wait a second. We can't even like put astronauts in space and bring them back on the dang Starliner.
National embarrassment. It truly, truly is a national embarrassment. Yeah.
Well, but that's not a, like people think, oh, that's a bug. No, that's a feature. They get to charge the government more money because they need new missions now to validate their things work, because cost plus contracting means if you sell the government a service for $100 and you get a 10% plus on top of that, then you get to make $10. If you can deliver them the exact same thing, but instead of charging them $100, you charge them $100,000 and you get your 10%, well, you just multiplied your profit by 1,000. Isn't that nice? So that's why, you know, if the company wants to make more money, they have to make things more expensively. And it's easy, like it is not hard to be inefficient in building something. It's hard to be efficient at building something. So anyways, that's, you know, and then you just multiply that across the entire government. You get these giant 1,000+ page bills that the Congress and the House have to, or the House and the Senate have to pass. And these things are just full of, okay, if you guys get what you want, then what we have to do is we need to give this amount of money to these lobbyists over here that helped me get elected, and this amount of money to these lobbyists over there who helped me get elected, and all these carve outs. Like, we just pay off people. Like, you know, people say third world countries have problems with bribes. Like, have you ever even seen how the House operates?
Yeah.
It's just giant payoffs all day long, every day.
Yeah. I think Boeing is such a beautiful microcosm of what's going on, because it's something that we, like you and I, follow very closely, sort of this aerospace space, which is tied to the SpaceX story, which is part of the Musk arc and stuff like that, that we follow closely on this channel. And Boeing is like a perfect, beautiful microcosm of what's going on. It's a company that has been in the news repeatedly for the last year or two, failure after failure after failure after failure, directly rooted to their either complete and utter failure to do a good job. So total, I'm blanking on the word, just being super
inept.
Yeah, dysfunctional, right? It's being super dysfunctional. And then, or, you know, let's take the other angle and also say corruption, right? But, you know, we'll put that aside for now. let's just say they're dysfunctional and inept, right? These are the same guys.
They are professionally dysfunctional.
Yes, they're professionally dysfunctional. These are the same guys that were paid, I think, 4 to 5 times more than SpaceX. Or how much? What was the delta between SpaceX and Boeing?
I don't know. It's a big number.
Yeah. Something like 3 to 5x. Somebody check me in the comments. But they were paid for the same exact job, to send astronauts into space at the same time. And then SpaceX did that 10, 12, 15, 16 times for a fraction of the cost of Boeing. And when Boeing gets to do that same exact thing for the first time, years after SpaceX did the first one, their astronauts are stuck in space because they did such a poor job. What the hell is that? And then those are the same people, us as taxpayers, pay for that Boeing screw up. And so if we're doing that there, what other places are we doing the same exact thing on? Where we have a benchmark in SpaceX that says, this is how much it should actually cost, and this is how it should work. It should be, 50 to 80% cheaper, and in this case, infinitely more useful for society, right? And so if that's the benchmark and you apply that to every single sector and industry in the United States where that's happening, but we don't have the SpaceX benchmark to tell us exactly how it should work, right? Then one, the safest assumption is that the United States government is overspending, likely by a factor of 2 to 3x at least. And that factor of 2 to 3x comes with worse outcomes. So the net impact to the United States, to the society, to us as citizens, we are getting 10 times less net impact to our society than we would have if they were actually being efficient. And that I cannot escape that conclusion. And this is why I've been losing my fucking mind since Clive has been born, because I'm looking and I'm like, how can it be like this? How can it be like this? And then, of course, I go back to my time at Tesla, where I'm like, wow, this company, I can't believe how well it functions at scale. This is unbelievable. Like, I cannot believe how good this company functions. It's chaos. It's crazy. But the amount of value per dollar that this company brings forward is insane compared to any other company I've been at before and all the friends that I talk to. And so, of course, obviously, if that's true there, then by default, that means that everything else is inefficient. If that's our benchmark, everything else is inefficient. Right. And that has been my struggle, is like wrapping my head around that and somehow being okay with that. That I need to be, and this is like my I'm driving myself nuts. Like, okay, what's within my control, what is not within my control? Right? With somebody with an audience now, okay, it's within my control to talk about this shit. Right? Which also means that I need to go out and find the things that are broken. But if I go out and find the things that are broken, I will die. Because everything's broken, you know. This goes back to our conversation from before. I'm a lot more positive about it now, though, because it's like yeah, just, you know, what is it, what are the 5 stages of grief? Acceptance at some point comes in.
Yeah, denial, the acceptance, anger space. Bargaining something in acceptance. Yeah
I like to think that I'm at the acceptance stage, but we'll see. I'm sure it might be like the bargaining part, but yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, to put a bow on the Boeing thing, they are the DMV of space.
Oh, that was good. That was good.
And that's, you know, that's Elon's point. Like, he says, just like when you think about how the government gets stuff done, just imagine the DMV being in charge of something that you care about. That's the government solution.
And I would argue that same exact thing happens on the corporate side too. But within the context of corporate, there's DMVs everywhere. But when you compare corporate to government, then corporates look like rock stars, right? But there's still a subset. There's a small subset of corporates that are not DMVs. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, DMVs exist everywhere. Most of the world is DMV. It's a DMV of a different subset. I don't know why I made that so complicated.
I was looking at the numbers. So I don't know how much Boeing has overrun this contract. I'm sure it's a lot, but the initial fixed price contract for Starliner was $4.2 billion. And it looks like SpaceX was valued at $2.6 billion. According to Perplexity, I haven't really dug into the sources to know if that's 100% correct, but usually Perplexity is pretty good. So it should at least be in the ballpark. And if those are not correct, Yeah, somebody go into the comments and correct.
Got it. So they pay, so we pay double, we, like, let's make it clear, the United States taxpayer paid double to Boeing to do a job that they haven't been able to do, that SpaceX has done more than 10 times for the last few years. And the first time that Boeing does that thing, they fall flat on their face.
Yep.
Nice. And so where else does that happen? My guess is in a lot of places. We just don't have SpaceX. We don't have the equivalent SpaceX in those places. So, nice. Joy to the world.
The government has come. they say the scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah, it's pretty, I'm always fascinated by how much, like, there's an effort to do. Even Clive is just crying about government spending. You hear him in the background? He's just crying. He's like, I can't believe we're spending so much money. It. Yeah, he gets it. Early age, 3 months, he already gets it. I think the thing that's always fascinating to me is, like, America has had such a, like, natural, and I say this as somebody who's an immigrant, right? I mean, I lived in Spain for 12 years before my parents moved. My parents are originally from Iran. You know, I've been to Iran a couple times when I was a kid, and I've been exposed to different cultures. It's just what is so unique about America is the allergic reaction to government. Even if we have a government, there's still a natural, with a lot of people that I talk to, even people on what I used to be on the left side of the aisle, I consider myself independent now, right? I don't associate myself with either party because I think both parties are broken.
Well, it sounds like you've taken the Ron Paul red pill from, 2004, 2008. I mean, this whole point is one that he was banging the drum on for a long time. And really still is today.
And I'm coming to learn that, because I've been so late getting into this game. This game being like understanding how the United States functions, which is driven a lot by politics. And so, the thing that I go through all the time is like, okay, so what, like that back to that, what's within my control, what isn't within my control, right? It's like, okay, if I look at how much I earn per year, right? And I look at the direct impact on me as an individual that the United States government has on me, right? Let's say their policy and whatever doesn't directly impact my day-to-day nearly as much outside of defense. They're keeping the bad guys out. Let's just assume that's happening, right? Our healthcare is a disaster. Our, like we said, Department of Education, you compare our test scores versus other countries, disaster, right? And I lived through this as somebody who was educated in Spain until I was 12 years old. And I showed up to the United States and I went to the public school system. And I'm like, why am I learning things I learned 3 years ago as an ESL student, right? So I'm like, what the hell is this, right? So let's set that aside. There's still this aversion from a lot of people that I hear that there's just a natural distrust in government. There's just a natural distrust in government. And with the First Amendment, we have the ability to voice that natural distrust in government, which I think is awesome. This is one of my favorite things about this country, like truly, is that if I have a problem, I can speak out and I feel like I can do that without worry that I'm somehow going to be persecuted for saying something that is directly at odds with how the government is functioning. Right? Because as an American, I have the right to voice my free speech, and if I want to be critical of the United States and the way they spend their money, the way they run their businesses, their lack of efficiency, some of the corrupt stuff that I see that's happening, which I still believe very strongly that it's a symptom of dysfunction, right? That we're just, there's too many people and too many hands in the pot that have the wrong incentive. And that's leading to corrupt outcomes, but it's not like some mastermind like, ooh, we need to make this happen so that we can enrich ourselves directly. It's more like people have the wrong incentives. There's too many people in the pot. And we've created this thing where it's okay for people to be wasteful. And so what's the outcome you're going to get? Gigantic waste. That's going to be viewed as corruption by many, right? So I feel comfortable voicing that, okay? But I think what's been happening, and this is something that I noticed, especially when I was more connected to, say, to the Democratic Party when it really ended in 2019, where I disassociated myself from that side of the political aisle, is that there is a ever-growing trust in that system, in the system that we have, that says, listen, we're here for a reason. We do it better than everybody. And we just have to keep trusting that they're going to keep doing it good. And the people in power are there for a reason. And they worked really hard to get there. And they're going to do a great job. And so if we don't trust that, and the media apparatus around that, right? They're the best equipped to bring you the truth because they're the professionals. They went to school for this. They got a college degree for this. So you have to trust. You have to trust the system, because if you don't trust the system, the whole thing collapses. And if you think that, there is gaps and cracks in the system, you're automatically a conspiracy theorist, right? Automatically. Let's not say the entire Democrat Party. Most people are very genuine and good and critical thinkers, but there is sort of this ever-growing set of the political party that will keep banging that drum, you know? And it's like, okay, so for me, this is my discovery process right now. It's been kind of fun, to be honest, because it's like I feel very uncomfortable going through it, because I am challenging. I love the way you're laughing right now. I'm challenging a lot of my preconceived notions I've had as somebody that very much aligned myself with one part of the political spectrum, and that spell was broken in 2019 for the right or wrong reasons. I'm just being very transparent about my journey, right?
So, what happened in 2019 specifically that broke the spell?
Two things specifically that happened. Number one, because I was following Tesla so closely, right, at that time, and I still am, but so closely at that time, I noticed a huge distortion of the truth by the mainstream media related to that story and Elon Musk and what was going on. Because I consider myself an expert in what was going on and still going on, electric vehicles, technology, Tesla specifically, right? So I consider myself, I can't tell you how many different, you and I did the same exact thing. We went through so much material to understand the story as best as we could. And then I watched the mainstream media's coverage of this, and I'm like, what is going on? How can you willingly just spread just incorrect information about the story? It's like, it blew my mind. And then I saw that, okay? And then I saw Andrew Yang was running for president at the time as well for the 2020 election on the Democratic side. And I saw his vision. I thought he had a very clear vision. He was thinking about the problems very differently. He was being a lot more pragmatic. And I was just listening to the source, right? And I was listening to his concepts. I was studying the concepts. And then when I watched the same mainstream media outlets that I would watch all the time, you know, CNN, MSNBC, right? And I would watch them take those concepts and just completely just either talk about them in a very unintelligent manner or just outright lying about it, and instead pushing a narrative of the party line, like the Biden, the AOC sort of like line of thinking, the Bernie Sanders, which, by the way, I respect Bernie Sanders a lot. What I really love about Bernie Sanders is that he sticks to what he thinks is right, and he hasn't changed that position because it's well-rooted, even though the DNC screwed him over and he sided with the DNC. Let's set that aside for now, okay? But so the point I'm trying to make here is that I saw multiple instances of things that I was very well-versed on, and I watched him just outright lie about those things. And I'm like, okay, if the media apparatus is doing this with those two individuals, okay, number one, what else are they lying about?
Question that I need to jump in with here. So you talked earlier, like one of the big hammers that gets wielded in society is conspiracy theorist. You're subscribing to a conspiracy theory. And then you're like, okay, whatever, you know. Now you witness mass lying campaigns that appear to be coordinated. What is that? Is that a conspiracy?
I have a theory for that. I have a theory. And this goes back to my dysfunction thing. It's like, I could be wrong. Listen, I'm an overly positive, naive person when it comes to a lot of like big visions for society. Okay. So I could totally have this wrong. I think what that is that a lot of people in media in general are liberal leaning, because it's an art. For some reason, in the United States, when you're on the art side, you're always more liberal. And then when you're not on the art side, when you're on the other side of the spectrum, like let's say non-college, for some reason, you're Republican. You're more conservative. That's just how this country stratified right now. Okay. So what's happened in the last 20 years is we've had more and more people that have the same ideology end up at the same places, reinforcing those ideologies, and they end up in those professions, carrying those biases with them, and they're projecting those biases on the world as if they were factual information, when in reality, subconsciously and maybe unknowingly, all they're really doing is propagating a political bias. And so I think that's what's been happening, because most people in media, it was my theory, most people in media are more liberal, and so they're going to project their worldview on the world. I'm not calling them bad or good people. I just think that's what's happening. And there's a lack of introspection into the biases that they're projecting, you know?
I love your commitment to Hanlon's razor. The pushback I would have for you is that there's a whole host of topics that these people are lying about, and they know they're lying about it. They have to say one thing in public when their actual personal opinions are different in private. You've had these conversations with these people. So they know that they are lying, and they know, what is the lie that I have to say? What is the lie that I have to publicly support? How is that not a big fat fucking conspiracy?
Can you point to a specific example?
COVID, you got to wear them masks. You got to. If you're not, you're killing your grandma. You're killing my grandma. We all know it's bullshit, but for God's sake, we've got to say it loud and enthusiastically.
But do you think those people actually did it? Like my challenge there would be, is a majority of those people actually believe that, right? And I think it was the chaos that we were in. You don't think so?
No, because their actions absolutely demonstrated that they did not. They had those parties. They didn't wear those masks. They got caught. They told the public one thing. They did something else.
Talking about this politician specifically. Yeah.
We'll use the politicians as an example, but I think that the vast majority of the people spouting that nonsense were no better than the politicians. The politicians are just an example of the thing that is the rule, not the exception. It's like, we all know that that's crap.
Yeah. I think, the hardest thing to say counteract that is that totally happened. That there's totally footage of individuals during the time where they were telling the public not to wear masks because they are putting people in danger. They themselves were not following the same thing that they were putting with like on the population, either because they didn't believe it, or because they viewed themselves as, I don't know, there's a host of different reasons. But the fact that they did that, the likeliest scenario is that they don't actually believe what they're saying.
The science says blah, blah, blah. Okay, wait a second. The science actually says that if you go outside, that this virus doesn't survive in the presence of UV light. It seems like going outside might be the best possible thing that someone could do in order to not spread the virus if they're going to be around people. But no, you must be inside with people, not outside with people, because the science says.
Yeah, weird. I mean, it's so weird. Do you think it feels like we haven't even attempted to get remotely close to recovering from that, from COVID?
No, we just memory hold it.
Yeah, we memory hold totally.
We just pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess if we tie it back to the original conversation we were having, is like, I mean, whatever the reason, stuff is not correct. There are big power structures that are not acting in a way that's befitting of people in those seats, and it could be the minority, it could be the majority, but there's clearly gaps. Right. And those are the ones that are getting the most attention. So the question becomes, how prevalent is it? And so if I use my example of the Boeings of the world being a cluster in respects to the what should be the benchmark, and you apply that to every other part of the U.S. government that is deploying cash in a way to move the country forward, then why wouldn't that same concept there, where most stuff is probably super inefficient, apply to something like policy and the enactment of policy and the execution of policy? It probably holds water, right? It's a theory.
Well, here's where I actually am somewhat optimistic, and I'm excited about, we're in conversations to have Joe Lonsdale on the podcast, and he's one of those types of people who, when he sees this kind of stuff, he has not only the intelligence, but also the resources to start doing some things. And he is actively involved in trying to figure out how do we realign incentives on a lot of this stuff so that we spend our money effectively. And one example is that he has funded the passing of legislation in a number of states and specific jurisdictions where they actually tie the amount of funding that probation offices get to the outcomes for those people who are getting out of jail. And I think they tied it specifically to what is the average income of the former inmate who's passing through that probation system. And they've seen like massive success on this, that instead of this being super wasteful and super non-impactful and just like terrible outcomes being the norm, then all of a sudden, you know, if you say, hey, this jurisdiction, you know, if you are able to have a lower recidivism rate and higher average wages this year than you had last year, the next year you'll get even more money. And so you got this kind of thing happening in, and this is not the only area of policy that he's trying to attack like this, but this is a great example of something that they're doing it, and they've seen great success. The thing that they have found is that a lot of times the highest leverage place that they can actually impact this change is at the state level. That this is really hard to do at the national level because there's just tons and tons of money that is spent on lobbying in Washington at the national level. And there's very, very little, especially by comparison at the state level. And so this is where they're focusing on doing this. And the cool thing about it is that once they do this at the state level and they have the data to back it up, then all of a sudden it's easy to approach someone in Washington with data seeing like, hey, this is something that we have tried, here's the data, it totally works. And then you have the ability for that, whether it's a congressman or a senator or whoever it is that you're trying to enact some legislative change, that they're not risking a whole lot reputationally to try out something. It's like, this is results that are known, and you can either be on the side of bringing these known results to your constituents, or you can be on the side of saying, no, we don't want to do something that we know works. And so it gets to be a little bit easier there. So,
sorry. So you're setting the right, it's just to make sure I understand this. So you're setting the right incentives for it to, for the right outcome to come to play. And then you're not punishing trying to innovate. You're allowing for things to be tried to find that optimal place. Okay. That's
brilliant. So the goal was, let's just identify what is the thing that we care the most about, and then let's tie our funding to the actual outcome that we want, and then let other people figure out how to achieve the outcome. And so, you know, they didn't tell these probation offices anything about how they should or should not run their office. They just said, hey, if you can provide better results next year than you did this year on recidivism and average wages, then you win, you get more money. If you do worse, you get less money. And like, it doesn't take long for that set of incentives to produce the right set of outcomes.
That's a very interesting. So help me understand, like, if I draw a parallel to the, like the SpaceX Boeing conversation we were having earlier, anybody can do this then? Like any of the people, like, I guess this would be, so who actually executes this? The city?
Yeah. So there are, I assume that this is stuff that is money that's allocated at the state level and then distributed down. So I don't know if it's distributed by cities or by counties. I'm not specifically familiar with that, but there's going to be, yeah, basically everyone, you know, all of the whatever that public service is, all of the groups that enact that public service in the state are then figuring out how to compete for
that's brilliant
success on those metrics that they've identified as being
but successful. It's result driven though, right? It's not like here's the plan and then you get the money. You actually have to generate the result and then you get the money,
or then you get more. It's like you start out with a you certain get more amount money.
Got it.
But yeah, you can increase, like you can grow, you can satisfy your desire to grow your budget by delivering results.
And this is where like the federal government could learn massively from this, because if I draw it to the Boeing and SpaceX parallel, they're just given the contracts to the companies that they've always given the contracts to, right? And so like other companies have to fight to be even allowed to be part of that pie, right? They have to like, they don't even have to show the results. They just have to say, this is the plan. And then if they have a lot of friends in politics, or they have a lot of lobbyists, which is really the bigger driver in this case for the federal government, then they are more likely to get the money instead of the actual results that they're generating. Because if it was driven by results, Boeing would not be part of any contract. They just wouldn't be by default, right? They would get $0 ideally. That's brilliant. So then the thought process becomes, so we're starting to do this at the state level with Joe, with his efforts, and then the much more difficult problem, because so like the one thing that I think about is like, okay, that's amazing for the state level. Like we'll feel that, right? But then all of us, if we look at the paychecks, if we look at all of our income as individuals that we generate outside of like the smallest few at the top of the ladder that, you know, do some shady shit to try to get around it, or the bottom 50% of the population that doesn't generate enough of an income to really even pay federal income tax, the largest percentage of our money goes to that body. So the largest percentage of our value creation and our exchange of time for money, we forego most of that in the pool that we give up to that body, federal government, which is by far the most inefficient, right? And so that's the struggle that I always face, which is like, okay, I have to focus about what I can control, and I have to focus about what's near me, because that's what actually impacts me. But if I look at my tax returns, okay, and I look at how much money I'm paying money to a place that I don't even feel confident they're even working one person as well as they should, you know? And like, that's my struggle. It's like, okay, so like where... And it's hard for me to swallow the pill that says, well, it's easier to make change at the local and state level. You just have to be okay with foregoing that money. That hurts, bro. I still do it, but boy, it hurts. It's very painful.
It's almost like we need a Department of Government Efficiency or something.
Ooh, that's a great idea. Did you just come up with that idea, Hans? My God, that's brilliant. Yeah, dude, that's, you know, and it's like, again, the more I dig into it, the more I'm like, you know, when I was younger and I didn't have to worry about much about this stuff, I was very content with just making more of myself, like just becoming who I am. And so like stuff like this wasn't really that front of mind for me. But now with little Clivey Poo, as I like to call him, I can't help but pay attention to that. I can't help but pay attention to it. It's brutal. It's brutal. Joy to the world.
The government has come.